May it please the Court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Jamil Edwards. Jamil Edwards was erroneously prevented from presenting relevant and material evidence that directly contradicted the state's case. In this case, the state presented a witness, Michael Mood, who had shared a jail cell with Mr. Edwards and another individual. He testified that while they were in jail, Mr. Edwards admitted to shooting and killing Ronald Johnson. Excuse me. He also told the jury that there was this third individual that was in the jail cell as well. This was critical testimony for the state because the state had no confession from Mr. Edwards. They had no evidence linking him to the case, and the only other witness had a motive to lie because he had received substantial benefit from the state, had a motive to kill Mr. Johnson as he was a competing drug dealer, and he made many inconsistent statements. So Mr. Edwards had to make an effort to discredit the statement by Mr. Mood. Mr. Mood had some credibility issues of his own. He was a racist, and he had also received some benefit from the state. The testimony that Mr. Garnett was going to testify to, who was the third individual in the jail cell, was that Mr. Edwards never admitted to shooting and killing Mr. Johnson, and in fact, he denied it. And the trial counsel specifically told the court that was exactly what he was to testify to.
I take it this was at the same time that the state's witness said he did admit to the killing.
Correct. I believe it was a different interpretation of the same conversation. Is that the question? What the state objected to was that Mr. Garnett's testimony contained hearsay, that the state was allowed to get in Mr. Mood's testimony because Mr. Edward was the party opponent, and that Mr. Garnett couldn't testify to the same purported conversation but different version of events because it would be hearsay. That's simply not true. This court recently, 2005, I believe, in Saudi Basic versus Mobile Danube, stated that a statement is not hearsay if offered only to prove that a statement was made rather than for the truth of the matter asserted. This court has also held repeatedly that when an out-of-court statement is offered to impeach a witness, it is not hearsay. And that's specifically what Mr. Edwards sought to do. And the court initially, reflexively, acknowledged that principle. And she stated, I think Garnett is allowed to testify as to what Edwards said at this stage of the game because the fact he has to be able to rebut what the state just did. But the state persuaded the court otherwise by using the case of Smith versus State. In that case, the defendant had sought to introduce a statement he made to the police saying the victim threatened him. He wasn't offering it to impeach anybody. He was simply offering it to advance his own case.
And what are the limits of the court's discretion in tailoring a what is admissible here? For instance, if the state's evidence is the defendant said, I did it, and the defense evidence is that was not said.
Correct.
That's one thing. But then if it's that was not said, and here's what really was said, and then it just goes on and on and on with testimony that should come from the witness stand and be subject to cross-examination. Does the judge have discretion to fashion a remedy that, well, you can't do the on and on and on part?
I think it depends on the facts, and in this case, I think he should have been permitted to testify to the substance, which, by the way, he wasn't even allowed to testify. No, he didn't say that, so that was even more restrictive. But in this case, the state's witness not only testified that Mr. Edwards said he did it, he testified there was this third person in the jail cell. He was the one, the state was the one that told the jury that. So in that case, the jury is left to wonder, if you pare it down to its basic facts, there are three people in a room, and the one person says that the other person told them he did it, and then they don't hear from this third person, but they know he exists because the state told them that, they're left to speculate, well, he must have the same version or else the defendant would have called him.
Well, the logical inference they would make is what you just said. It wouldn't be speculation. It would
Correct.
Be a logical inference. The defense would have called him if he was going to offer anything to the contrary.
That's correct.
But because they didn't, it's fair to assume he'd just say the same thing.
Correct. And if by putting, this, as the state suggested, that the defendant could have testified, putting him on wouldn't have solved that problem for him in this case, because oftentimes the jury would expect him to give a self-serving statement. But if they have these two individuals who both were present giving different versions of events, they could then make a credibility determination.
Now, what role are you suggesting race played in this?
Well, simply that Mr. Mood had a motive to lie. It's another credibility issue in this case. My client is African-American. He actually used, Mr. Mood actually used racist comments in my client's presence, and he had a swastika tattoo and testified that essentially he didn't care for minorities. So that coupled with the benefits he got from the state already.
That's all of that's in the record, that he had a swastika? The jury heard all that?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And
I understand from the record you had a full opportunity to impeach him based on racism and based on the benefit that he got.
Yes.
There's no argument about that.
Correct. He was. However, as I stated, the not having the opportunity to present the other witness left over the question for the jury. It may have been a different scenario had the jury never known that this other person existed. However, the case law by this court has made it clear that offering out-of-court statements for impeachment purposes is not hearsay, simply not hearsay. This court held that in Castlevera versus State, which was a murder case in which the state was allowed to present the victim's handwritten note to impeach the defendant. In Gurr versus State, an out-of-court statement by the doctor was not hearsay because it was offered to impeach a witness. And again, as I mentioned, the Saudi case, the defendants were allowed to offer hearsay to use against the other party, and it was, an out-of-court statement, which was not hearsay. And the cases cited by the state for the proposition that it is not admissible are not our case. Smith versus State was not an impeachment case. He was just trying to, on his own, advance his case. Here, the state presented evidence. They took the initiative to present this evidence, and Mr. Edwards had the right to confront him as to what actually was said. The other case cited by the state is United States versus Sevicic, which is a Third Circuit case. And they seem to indicate throughout their brief that Mr. Edwards was trying to circumvent the hearsay rules so that he didn't have to testify. What the courts are concerned about with the circumvention of the hearsay rules is what is seen in Sevicic, where the defendants were trying to pin the crime on a third party. So they got a witness. They wanted a witness to testify that he told her that he did the killing. And the court said, no, I'm not going to allow that, but I will allow you to call this third party. And there were some logistical problems, so he was going to accommodate that. The defendants then said, well, we're not going to call him because we know he's going to deny it, and that doesn't help our case. That is completely different than our case, where the state has put the evidence on the record, and Mr. Edwards has the opportunity to challenge that.
Should there be, assuming that the judge erred and the testimony should have been allowed in toto, including all the exculpatory things that the witness was not allowed to say, should there be a limiting instruction?
Oh, as to impeachment purposes, yes.
Right, and cannot be considered for the truth of the matter?
That's correct. Yes, absolutely. And I don't think that trial counsel would have had a problem with that because he told the court that that's why he was presenting it. Now, the court could find that this is hearsay, and if it does so, it still should have been admitted under the residual rule simply because of the interests of justice. Both statements were purportedly made by the defendant to two convicted felons in a jail cell, and the level of trustworthiness inherent in Garnett's proposed testimony would be no less than that of the state's. And his rights were violated by preventing this. It was... Error goes directly central part of the case. As I mentioned, this was the only direct means of linking Mr. Edwards to the crime. Now, Timothy Davis testified that he was there at the time of the shooting, and that he also was a competitive with the victim as far as drug sales are concerned. He also offered inconsistent statements, and he also had a motive to lie because he had received a possession plea on a possession with intent to deliver where he had 47 bags of cocaine and was facing 20 years. So that was the state's link to Mr. Edwards without Mr. Mood, and that was very suspect. So to have Mr. Mood, have someone say from Mr. Edwards' mouth he admitted to committing this crime was substantial to their case. And so Mr. Edwards was denied his compulsory process rights under the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution, U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 7 of the Delaware Constitution, and also a fair trial he was denied. It is fundamental to a defendant's rights that he be able to put on witnesses in his own defense and to put the state to a test its evidence. In United States versus Foster, which is a federal case out of the District of Columbia Circuit, the court held that the defendant has the right to explain away the force of specific items of the government's proof by showing extrinsic evidence of another hypothesis. Mr. Edwards should not have been put in the position where he had to testify and give up his right and testify when there was other relevant material evidence that would have contradicted the state's evidence.
Now, your assumption of this argument is that it was admissible under the rules, or are you saying that evidence that's inadmissible under the rules of evidence must be constitutionally allowed?
Well, under the rules, it should have been allowed, and additionally, if the court finds that the hearsay rules prevent it, that in and of itself, in this set of circumstances, still violates his rights, because it just, if you, as I mentioned earlier, and Justice Steele recognized, the bottom line fairness of the adversary process allows for this. You got two people who are going to testify to two different versions of events to a specific and clearly direct part of the state's case, and you're not going to allow one to get up and tell his version of events. That is fundamentally unfair because that goes precisely to his rights. If there are no questions, thank you.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, state obviously disagrees with Ms. Walker's position on this, with the defense position. Rules are rules, and what sauce with the goose is sauce with the gander. This was hearsay, not within any exception. The bottom line is that Mr. Davis was not his own party opponent. He wanted to proffer Mr. Garnett's, or the proffer was that Mr. Garnett would testify, not simply that he was a cellmate and never heard him say anything of this kind. He wanted to say, Garnett wanted to say, I was privy to this conversation. I remember the conversation, and what Mr. Edwards said was not what Mr. Muday, by the way, that's what I've been told, and not what Mr. Muday said that he made, that he said he did it. He said just the opposite. He said, I didn't do it. I denied it.
Well, how do you disprove the testimony of your state's witness if you cannot call another witness who says that's not what was said?
As the judge recognized, Mr. Edwards, she said, you have a choice to make. And it may not be, you can get this statement in, you can get this testimony in, but it may not be the choice you want to make, and that is you have to testify on your own behalf.
Well, wait a second. I want to pursue that. Let's assume that he decided this was a bad situation, I'm going to have to take the stand. And I'm going to, in my testimony, I'm going to explain that, yeah, I remember that conversation, and that's not what I said. I said the exact opposite. At that point, would Mr. Garnett be allowed to testify or not?
Yes. He could be 12 to the witness stand, and he could say, yes, I heard that conversation, and I agree with Mr. Edwards, and I disagree with Mr. Muday. Mr. Muday is lying when he said that Mr. Edwards made that statement, and Mr. Edwards was telling the truth.
Well, why wouldn't that testimony be hearsay?
Because the witness, the declarant, is on the stand. The declarant has testified. That's the big problem here. The declarant is not on the witness stand. And all kinds of red hearsay flags go up when any party is trying to introduce a statement when the declarant is absent. And
can a conversation at any time be a fact which can be proved or disproved? Just the mere fact that the conversation happened.
Certainly. Certainly.
Why isn't that what was going on here?
Well,
your witness was saying this is the conversation that happened. Another witness is saying, no, that's not what happened. It would sort of be like at the Super Bowl, Prince sang the national anthem, and somebody says, no, Prince didn't sing the national anthem. He sang Purple Rain. Aren't those facts which can be proved by testimony of witnesses?
I certainly agree with Your Honor. Yes, there are times in a trial when you simply want to say that such and such did not happen, and you're not looking beyond that to the truth of the matter. So we're not trying to prove, for example, that Purple Rain did in fact sing. We are trying to say that so-and-so said that Purple Rain sang, or that so-and-so said that Purple not didn't, I assume that's a group, that Purple Rain did not sing. That's fine. If all you want to show is that somebody said that, not that Purple Rain sang. The problem here is that Mr. Edwards doesn't simply want to say that this statement, which was my statement, was this, it wasn't that. What he wants to go is beyond that and prove, in fact, that Purple Rain sang or Purple Rain did not sing. That is, that I did or did not shoot Mr. Johnson.
But here the witness was precluded from even contesting the fact that the conversation occurred. Isn't that so?
Well, the witness could as I said, Mr. Davis could certainly take the witness stand and say, yes, I was a cellmate. I was in the cell with them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I certainly never heard any conversation like that. What he cannot say is that I was privy to the conversation, and here's what Mr. Edwards said, because Mr. Edwards is, A, not a party opponent of himself, and so the not hearsay rule does not come into play, and he's not a declarant, and so whatever Mr. Edwards says, he is a declarant, but he's not a witness, and so that's hearsay unless it falls into a well-recognized exception to the hearsay rule.
He didn't testify to either of those points, did he, that the conversation never occurred or that this is really what Mr. Edwards said? He didn't testify to either one.
Garnett was never called.
I thought he was offered.
He was offered. And he was offered to testify that he was privy to the conversation and that he would say this is what Mr. Edwards actually said. That was the only proffer. He was not proffered to say that he was going to, he was not proffered as a witness who would say simply, I never heard the conversation.
So it was based on the proffer that it would go to the second step that resulted
yes.
in it being barred.
Yes. Are
you familiar with Dutton versus Evans? United States Supreme Court case?
I probably am, but I can't.
Well, my question, if you are, and if you're not, that's fine. Did the defendant Evans in that case testify? Do you recall?
No, I don't.
It's a case similar to ours in the sense that Evans was the defendant. He wanted to call a witness to rebut testimony that was damaging to him by a government witness in that case, not the state, obviously. And the purpose was to rebut that the specific conversation had actually occurred. And the United States Supreme Court said that was not hearsay. But what I don't know off the top of my head is whether or not Evans actually testified. You seem to believe that that makes the difference. If Mr. Edwards had testified here, that would have made a difference. And I don't know whether Evans testified in Dutton versus Evans or not.
If in the Dutton v. Evans case, what he wanted to testify to was that, along with what Justice Risley was talking about, that a certain conversation never occurred, as Mr. Garnett could testify to here, you know, I was with these people, and to the best of my knowledge, you know, being with these people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, this conversation never occurred. He could certainly testify to that.
But one thing's clear, the trial judge did not tailor it. The trial judge did not say, your proffer is rejected as to the second step. But Mr. Garnett can testify that he was present when Moody's conversation, or Moody, however it's pronounced, conversation, when Moody testified about a conversation, I was present to that at the same time the conversation supposedly took place, and the conversation never did take place. He wasn't even allowed to testify to that.
No, that was never proffered. That Mr. Maurer never proffered the testimony of Mr. Garnett, that I never heard that conversation.
Well, and that's part of what's troubling me, because you've got three parties to a conversation, and or allegedly three parties to a conversation, and you're saying it would be fine if Garnett were going to get up and testify and say, I shared a cell with these guys, so I was with them all the time, and I can tell you that there was never such a conversation. That would be okay, but because that would be untrue, if we believe Garnett, then he gets to not testify at all, because the only true statement he could make is, yeah, I was there, and there was such a conversation, but it wasn't the way it's been described to you. So you seem to be saying that it would be acceptable and not a hearsay problem if the way it played out was that there was no such conversation, but because there was such a conversation, Garnett couldn't testify to that without lying about there not being a conversation, and then he doesn't get to say what did happen. That there seems to be an inconsistency there is what I'm getting at.
Well, I suppose it comes down to, again, what Justice Risley was talking about, the difference between testimony going to whether a particular conversation occurred at all, or testimony as to what was said in order to prove the truth of the matter asserted in the conversation, which is, it is our point, our position here is what they wanted to get in this case.
Well, why is testimony that a conversation never occurred not testimony, to use the law school phrase, as to whether there's a conversation at all or not? It's true there was a conversation or it's not true. But it's okay, it's not hearsay to testify that it's untrue that a conversation took place. But it is hearsay to testify as what took place in the conversation.
Yes.
Why is that a principled distinction?
Well, in this particular case, Mr. Garnett, again, that was never the proffer.
Well, I'd like to get your comment on this. This is at A32. After trial judge rules, Mr. Maurer says, I anticipated the court might rule against me. Would I be permitted to ask the witness whether he ever heard the defendant make the statements attributed to him, the court? No. I think it involves, that's just as much eliciting inadmissible hearsay as not. Is that error?
Well, it depends on what Mr. Maurer, if Mr. Maurer wants Mr. Garnett to testify, okay, I heard the conversation, this specific conversation, and he never said that. That, I think, would be hearsay. The only thing that would not be hearsay is the conversation never occurred. In other words, I never heard it. I was in the jail cell with these guys all this time, and I can say I never heard a conversation like this.
Well, you keep putting that to us as an ipsy-dixit. The question is, why is that a principled distinction? Because it speaks to the truth of whether a conversation occurred at all or not.
That's not what Mr. Maurer wanted to bring on. Because that would really be almost meaningless, that he didn't hear the conversation. Well, maybe it was a private conversation. There's no necessity for Mr. Garnett to be privy to the conversation. But Mr. Maurer wants...
Well, I thought the whole assumption was that they're all three in a cell, and that the inference drawn both ways is anything one said to the other would have been heard by the other two.
Right. No? In all likelihood, but certainly not a established
fact.
This
isn't a 4,000-square-foot penthouse.
No.
This is a jail cell.
But they have to establish that each one was together and one was not asleep while the others were awake, whether one was not taken to the infirmary, something like that.
Well, why would Garnett have a problem saying the conversation didn't take place because I was awake?
Well, he has to first establish that he was privy to this specific conversation. That's where the problem comes in, because they're there in the cell for an extended period of time. It's not like they're at a specific location, and one says, oh, yes, A and B were talking together, and they said this, and the other number C said, oh, I was at that location, and A and B never talked to each other. I will, you know, without getting into what the conversation was.
Well, Mude, or whatever his name is, through his testimony, did he say it occurred on a particular day?
No. No. As a matter of fact, I don't believe Mr. Mude even recalled. He recalled there being a third cellmate, but he couldn't say who that third cellmate was. This was about 2 years later, and I suppose Mr. Mude had been through a number of cellmates by that time. He couldn't even recall who the third cellmate was.
He couldn't recall who his cellmates were, but he had no problem recalling the specifics of a particular conversation.
But Mr. Maurer did a wonderful job of destroying Mr. Mude on cross-examination, bringing out everything. There was certainly a great deal of impeachment here, and indeed, even to having Mr. Mude pull up his pant leg and show his swastika to the jury. So the judge...
But he was not allowed to introduce evidence that Mr. Garnett never heard the defendant make the statements attributed to him.
I never really finished that. The proffer that Mr. Maurer made there, that sort of secondary proffer, had he elaborated on it and said, well, all I want to do is put Mr. Garnett on the stand to say, look, I was in the cell with these guys, I never heard the conversation. But that does not seem to be what he wants to get to. He wants to put, and he really has to. He's bound to this, because we're not talking about a conversation that occurred at a specific time. He has to say that Mr. Garnett did hear a conversation, and then he's going to say, but what Mr. Edwards said was not what Mr. Mude said. That's basically what he's going to have to say for this to have any real evidentiary value at all. Just getting on the stand and saying, well, I was with these guys over a period of 4 months and I never heard this conversation.
That testimony would be admissible under the rules of evidence.
Pardon me?
That testimony, as you've paraphrased it, would be admissible.
Certainly. You say, yeah, I never heard it. I was there. I was incarcerated with these guys for 3 months, and I never heard them talk about that. What he can't get into is, oh, I heard that conversation all right, but what Mr. Mude said was a lie. Now, that's just the same as saying, I heard the conversation. What Mr. Edwards said was, I didn't do it. Six of one, half dozen of the other. So based on that secondary proffer, I think that's what the trial judge was thinking about, that this is what is going to be the testimony. We're not getting into that because that's hearsay, not within any exception.
What happens to this case if Mr. Mude's testimony stands, but we find that Mr. Garnett should have been able to contradict it? What happens?
Well, I think considering the credibility of both these people, I would say it's a harmless error if letting this case certainly... Back up a little. This case certainly does not rise or fall on testimony of either Mr. Mude or Mr. Garnett.
Well, then it's not true, as been proffered by your colleague, that the state had no other evidence of Edwards' involvement other than Mude.
No. Well, we have the testimony, of course, the eyewitness testimony or ear witness testimony of Mr. Davis, who was present when Mr. Johnson was shot, although he didn't see the actual shooter. He did testify. There were only three of us there, and I didn't do the shooting, and Mr. Johnson died, therefore that leaves Mr. Edwards. And we also had the letter that Mr. very incriminating letter that Mr. Edwards wrote in Mr. Davis's name and sent to Mr. Davis for him to send to Mr. Maurer, recanting his original statement to the police. So those two together were certainly rather powerful evidence of guilt there. Again, Mr. Davis not being particularly credible, but then Mr. Edwards sending this bogus letter in Davis's name to Davis to forward to Mr. Maurer. So those two together were certainly certainly evidence. Again, well, how the jury took Mr. Mudet's testimony, I don't know. Mr. Maurer just tore him apart under cross-examination. But they may have accepted it and may not have. But again, I don't think it was critical to the state's case. But
so if I understand correctly, the two parts of the state case, if we keep Mr. Mudet out of it, would be Davis's testimony, and Davis was not a perfect witness because he had his own problems, right?
And no, these were all drug dealers.
Okay. So we've got Davis's testimony and then Edwards' letter, and that's it.
That's pretty much what points to Mr. Edwards. Davis is the primary incriminating witness.
Okay, so on the grand scale of these things, would you consider this one of the state's stronger cases, or you know, so-so, or weak, or what?
The case that obviously hinged on the credibility of Mr. Davis. If you believe Mr. Davis, it's a very strong case because we have an eyewitness to the murder. If you don't believe Mr. Davis, well, the verdict is not guilty, and that's basically what it is. Do you believe Mr. Davis or don't you?
So as opposed to a case where you have other ballistic evidence or independent kind of witnesses or anything like that, all you've got is one person who's part of the gang, if you will, of
drug dealers.
who's testifying against another one.
Testifying against another one. And then corroborating that to some extent would be Mr. Edwards' attempt to write the letter for Mr. Davis to recant his statement to the police, which Mr. Davis' girlfriend, I believe, then forwarded to the proper authorities. So the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a couple of points. First, I believe I heard Mr. Donovan actually concede that there was error because Mr. Garnett was not permitted to testify that the conversation never took place. He wasn't allowed to do that. Mr. Maurer told the court that that would be part of his testimony, and that would be found at A31, and it's page 90 there. And again, on the subsequent day where Justice Ridgely pointed out, Garnett did take the stand. He wasn't just proffered. He did take the stand, and the state objected just prior to this testimony. And the fact that Mr. Mudet did testify that Mr. Garnett was present at the time, and he stated the conversation took place in July or August of 2004. The case is weak for the state without Mr. Mudet. It's weak with it. However, the jury did, in fact, believe the state's case. However, Mr. Davis, it's true, if the jury believes him, it's a strong case. If the jury doesn't believe him, it's not. That misses the whole point, that his credibility was significantly hampered in this case. And to have someone else to corroborate that particular individual is would have significant to the state's case. So this would not be harmless error. Otherwise, the state wouldn't have put Mr. Mudet on if they felt that they had a strong case to begin with. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.